opening words. Native Americans have an ethic which respects the land and all its creatures as sacred. The great mythologist Joseph Campbell referred to it as Paleolithic moral order. Our roots in the West have a different moral order, not the same as that of our great prophets. In Genesis 1:28, we are told to be fruitful and multiply and have dominion over the fowl, beasts, and fish. In 1493, Pope Alexander VI wrote the Doctrine of Discovery, which gave European colonists rights to the land of the indigenous people and to enslave them. In the United States, we had the manifest destiny to take over the whole continent. In this, where is the golden rule? There is no compassion or respect at all. However, at least some of us have come a long way, as clearly shown by our seven principles. Our guest speaker today is Dr. John Larry Kelland. Larry was born in East Orange, New Jersey on January 31st, 1938. He grew up in Livingston, New Jersey between 1940 and 1960 and attended Grover Cleveland High School in Caldwell, New Jersey. Larry attended Rutgers University while commuting to Newark and obtains its BA in biology in 1960. Dr. Kelland received his PhD in biology from Princeton in 1964. Larry has taught at the University of Toronto and then at Finch College between 1971 and 1975 as chair of the science department. He received his master's in library science from Queen's College in 1976 and has been a reference librarian at the University of Georgia, Clemson, and then at URI between 1940 and 2008. Larry's hobbies include photography, birdwatching, travel, and reading about developments in science and all environmental matters. We are quite fortunate to have him with us here today. Larry?
In wildness is the preservation of the world. And I think that Henry David Thoreau really meant the character of some people or beings being wild, different from controlled. Now, part of my sermon has to do with the golden rule and part the seventh principle. We'll start more or less on the golden rule. I believe I can use a scientific perspective to shed new light on some of our ethical principles. And I am looking at it all from the outside. Sometimes I think we need to go outside and just see what does it look like. During this talk, I'll be referring on occasion to vast stretches of time, millions, even billions of years. Our seventh principle points to our being a part of the interdependent web. But just how intertwined are we, humans, with the rest of the animal world and with other species? Profoundly. I want to first discuss evolutionary relationships and then something about the origins of our conscious mind and the ethical implications. I have a book at home, actually I have it with me, called The Last Human. It has eight different authors. It covers 22 species in the family Hominidae, which is our family, in terms of biological classification. The early species were rather ape-like, and the later ones looked a lot like us. In fact, some of the early species in the family could be called the grassland ape because they could stand up instead of climbing the trees. They could stand up and walk. Some of these species evolved into other later ones. Some went extinct, but they are all gone, except for Homo sapiens. We are the last human. Now, each of these earlier species probably numbered into the thousands, but nothing like our huge population. About 30,000 years ago, there were apparently four species in the genus Homo, that is, four kinds of people on the Earth side by side. Can you imagine? We're not used to that. We're used to being the one. But the four were our species, the Neanderthals, the Denisovans, which in Siberia were once thought to be Neanderthals, and then Homo floresiensis, which is that newly discovered one in Indonesia, and they were small people. Now, if these four kinds of people were here today, would the golden rule apply to them, or just to us, just to Homo sapiens? Who does it apply to? They are all gone, and we may not have good evidence as to why they went extinct, but to me, this all has implications, especially implications for our understanding of the conscious mind, and this has profound implications for our ethical principles. There are some traits which distinguish us as humans from all other animals. Now that all the intermediates are gone, so we're pretty separate, it seems, from the rest, but not if we look back in time. We have language, abstract thought, ability to plan, spectacular ability to build, and intelligence and reasoning ability. But some of these human traits have precursors among animals, and even though they are far, far simpler in the animals, there are some traits we share with other animals, though not the advanced aspects of the conscious mind. But I am convinced that the basic aspects of our own conscious mind, sensory perception, memory, some kinds of planning and strategizing, exist in many species. I believe consciousness has existed in other species for many millions of years, far, far predating our own species, and that we inherited the basis of consciousness from prior species. There are certainly other species who can experience positive sensations and can suffer. You have pets and you know this, but I wanted to provide a kind of background context for discussion. I note that when people talk about the golden rule, they just focus on humans. This almost makes it seem that a fundamental aspect of the golden rule is that it applies just to humans. I think we need to place the golden rule on a firmer logical foundation. I think the ability of a person or an animal to have positive and negative experiences and our ability to promote their well-being, that is the underlying basis for the golden rule. So we should broaden the golden rule to apply to other sentient species, or at least we should have some sort of compassion, and that this broadening ought to be built into our religion. We could extend our first principle like this: inherent worth and dignity of every person and the inherent worth of other species. When I worked at a URI library, I was on a committee, the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, which managed the treatment of animals in laboratories. I was the information officer, that is, charged with helping scientists find alternate treatments to surgery, for example, if such existed. This is by searching the literature. This is all based on compassion for animals and governed by the Animal Welfare Act and overseen by the USDA, it seems to It seems to me that you can embrace compassion to animals who are conscious and build this into our principles and our religion. A lot of religions don't say a word about anything other than humans, you know, but we could. They can't, but anyway. Well, that is what I wanted to say about the golden rule, and especially the first principle. Now, the seventh principle. I see a problem with our seven principles. By the way, I should mention that in your hymnal, the large hardbound hymnal, in the first few pages, a couple pages after the preface, there are the principles if you want to look at them. I should have printed something out, but anyway. But I see a problem with our seven principles. The first six deal only with human issues, and then suddenly the seventh, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. And this is enormous. We got it here, yeah. I'd like to quote Don Southworth, who is a wrote an article on the web about what happened at one of the General Assemblies in 1984. I'll truncate this a little. One of our ministers present, Paul Leroux, offered an amendment to the floor. He suggested we replace the proposed language of the seventh principle. That language is respect for the earth and the interdependence of its living systems. With new words, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. It was with those words, the eternal breath of life, the spirit of guidance, the wisdom inherent in our human condition spoke out again to the world of a new possibility, a new hope, of a new Unitarian and new universalism. Well, those are beautiful words, a lot of my readings indicate that Unitarians writing about the seventh principle interpret it sometimes one way. Sometimes they seem to be talking about just the earth or how it relates to people. Others times they talk about it being universal and referring to the whole universe, which is what it sounds like to me. I have a couple of books of essays on the seven principles, and I can see this variety since people seem to me to be reading into it much more than it says. If I were on the outside and didn't know anything about Unitarianism and just saw this for the first time and read the seventh principle, I would think it meant the whole universe. So that's what I'm thinking it may look like. But anyway, I do see a lot of variation since people are reading into it much more than it says. Let's get some precision and clarity into it. I think especially for non-Unitarians, because we want to speak to the outside, we want them to understand what we're about. Especially for non-Unitarians, we should make explicit three levels between Homo sapiens alone and the whole web. Level one would be non-human species. Two, the great ecosystems of the world, such as forests or coral reefs or savannas. Three, the great life support systems, air, soil, water, fresh water, the oceans, all of which we depend for our very existence. And I would include great cycles like the carbon cycle, calcium, and so forth. The purpose here is to more clearly show our appreciation of the great moral problems relating to environmental crises, because these are becoming more and more to the forefront, and also to make sure everyone knows we have a green commitment. So I'm looking at message to the outside world, outside of our own faith and church. Now, how would you assess the value of the principal ecosystems, the huge biodiversity and beauty of them hints at their value. The Earth is 4.6 billion years old, and we know that life on the Earth originated at least 3.8 billion years ago, if not earlier. During the first 3 billion years or so, there were only single-celled microbes on the Earth. The majority of the history of the planet, there were just bacteria, basically. And around 600 million years ago, or maybe a little more, some event took place that gave us multicellular life. That is us, all the animals and plants. And it developed with some major extinction events, but into the world we know today. It took a vast stretch of time to build life on this Earth as we see it now. Most of that time, we did not exist. I think this means that this means that life on Earth has its own inherent worth independent of us. Forests and coral reefs existing for such a vast stretch of time ought to make us understand why they are precious. We also should consider a principle or two which give not just respect but inherent worth to other species, to our beautifully interconnected ecosystems, and to the Earth's life support systems. Why? To make it clearer that this church means to deal with really major environmental issues of our time, incorporate them into our theology, and be the religion for our time, which only we can be. Now, I want to close up and do a marvelous quote in a minute. But first, I just want to mention that, you know, we have, if we look out beyond the Earth, we see our solar system with its nine planets, and only one of which has the kind of life that we're seeing here, out here. But astronomers have discovered something like 1,000 planets outside the solar system, but in their own solar systems out there and within the galaxy. And now that number, 1,000, that changes all the time as they find new ones. And most of what they find are apparently either too hot or too cold, or their orbit or something makes it look like they could never support life the way we have it here. So, I am indebted to Dave Hurtis, who brought out another principle in his sermon last year, because he talked about that. I recently read a book, Alone in the Universe, by John Gribben, an astrophysicist. He covers many factors which indicate that it is rare for a planet like the Earth to have an uninterrupted 4.6 billion years, which has allowed life to evolve to the point where there are intelligent beings who have technological civilization. After reading it, I think we are indeed very rare in the universe. Gribben thinks we are alone, and I think we are at least rare, although there may be many planets around other stars with life at the level of bacteria, or other beings which can withstand harsh conditions. What Dave pointed out, referring to all of these outer planets, the rarer, the more precious. In other words, the rarer the Earth is, if the Earth is really very rare in having the kind of life we have, it makes it very precious. And I'm calling this the rarity principle, but I appreciate Dave for bringing it out. Maybe it should be the Hurtis principle. But anyway, here's a sort of the back to clarify the rarity principle. What if the Earth were absolutely unique in the universe in having life or intelligence among all the galaxies? What a shame if we ran it down or ruined it. So I look at the rarity principle as the basis, the foundation of all our environmental moral principles, giving the earth and its life inherent worth. The other side of the story, instead of looking at the past or the future, sustainability could be the major criterion by which to judge all of our major activities in the world. What I want to do here is quote Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist. And here's what he says, and he's quoting a letter. Now, there's a lot of vagary about just what Chief Seattle said here, but I will quote this anyhow, and I hope that not everyone has heard all of this. But anyway, according to this is Bill Moyers interviewing Joseph Campbell. Campbell, Chief Seattle was one of our last spokesmen of the Paleolithic moral order. In about 1852, the U.S. government inquired about buying the tribal lands for the arriving people of the United States, and Chief Seattle wrote a marvelous letter in reply. His letter expresses the moral, really, of our whole discussion. Now, Chief Seattle says, "The president in Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land. But how can you buy or sell the sky, the land? The idea is strange to us. If we do not own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, how can you buy them? Every part of this earth is sacred to my people. Every shining pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark woods, every meadow, every humming insect, all are holy in the memory and experience of my people. We know the sap which courses through the trees as we know the blood that courses through our veins. We are part of the earth and it is part of us. The perfumed flowers are our sisters. The bear, the deer, the great eagle, these are our brothers. The rocky crests, the juices in the meadow, the body heat of the pony, the man, all belong to the same family. The shining water that moves in the streams and rivers is not just water, but the blood of our ancestors. If we sell you our land, you must remember that it is sacred. Every ghostly reflection in the clear waters of the lake tells of events and memories in the life of my people. The water's murmur is the voice of my father's father. The rivers are our brothers. They quench our thirst, they carry our canoes and feed our children. So you must give to the rivers the kindness you would give to any brother. If we sell you our land, remember that the air is precious to us and that the air shares its spirit with all the life it supports. The wind that gave our grandfather his first breath also receives his last sigh. The wind also gives our children the spirit of life. So if we sell you our land, you must keep it apart and sacred as a place where man can go to taste the wind and that is sweetened by the meadow flowers. Will you teach your children what we have taught our children, that the earth is our mother? What befalls the earth befalls all the sons of the earth. This we know. The earth does not belong to man. Man belongs to the earth. All things are connected like the blood that unites us all. Man did not weave the web of life. He's merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself. One thing we know. Our God is also your God. The earth is precious to him, and to harm the earth is to heap contempt on its creator. Your destiny is a mystery to us. What will happen when the buffalo are all slaughtered, the wild horses tamed? What will happen when the secret corners of the forest are heavy with the scent of many men and the view of the ripe hills is blotted by talking wires? Where will the thicket be? Gone. Where will the eagle be? Gone. And what is it to say goodbye to the swift pony and the hunt? the end of living and the beginning of survival. When the last red man has vanished with his wilderness and his memory is only a shadow of a cloud moving across the prairie, will these shores and forests still be here? Will there be any of the spirit of my people left? We love this earth as a newborn loves its mother's heartbeat. So if we sell you our land, love it as we've loved it. Care for it as we have cared for it. Hold in your mind the memory of the land as it is when you receive it. Preserve the land for all children and love it as God loves us all. As we are part of the land, you too are part of the land. This earth is precious to us. It is also precious to you. One thing we know, there is only one God. No man, be he red man or white man, can be apart. We're brothers after all. Okay, that was it. Thank you.
The realm of inherent worth is vast. I consider it all to be life on earth and the land and all to have inherent worth. The native people of our continent believe it to be sacred, and so it is.